and welcome to another episode of Ninjas and Bots, a weekly comics book podcast that covers the IDW runs of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and the Transformers in an alternating pattern. So this week, well, I should introduce myself. I'm Lane.
And I'm John.
And together we are
Lane-tron. Wild Stallions. Oh, sorry.
See, this is what happens when I go off script. So, like I said, we're covering Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles stories this time. We're going to cover issue number 10 of the IDW and the micro series look at Splinter Sensei.
Splinter.
And John is going to lead us on the synopsis.
Yay. So yes, issue 10, continuing our Shadows of the Past story arc. This was released on May 30th, 2012. The Dan Duncan cover has the Shredder with his new IDW design strutting his stuff toward the camera. And the Kevin Eastman cover has him leaping toward the camera over a horde of katana-wielding ninja. What'd you think of the covers?
I thought they were amazing as usual. Let me see. Let me back up. I opened up the wrong tab. Sorry. I didn't see the other one, but the one with Shredder kind of stalking menacingly toward the point of view. It's the same thing with Megatron. Megatron in the cartoons was just like the typical 80s, 90s bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Mildly intimidating, but, you know, family friendly and more often than not, the butt of the jokes of the good guys.
Right.
But the IDW Megatron is scary. The IDW Shredder is also scary.
Very scary.
I don't want anything to do. I do not want to walk down a dark alley with this guy. I don't even want to pass him on a subway because he's like decked out in a cheese grater. No one can brush shoulders with him without getting some, like, quite a few lacerations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he's a serious bad guy, but nice, moody cover, the one that I'm looking at.
I really like the design, the colors, the all-black clothing with the red, like, you know, fabrics around him. He has a sort of sash belt and a cape that are red, and they look good on the cover. They stand out even more on the interior artwork with the coloring. And Karai has a similar mm-hmm. aesthetic with her clothes. So,
yeah,
really like this design for the Shredder. And with his background being what it is, emphasizing the samurai nature of the helmet by having it with the tears, I think works really, really mm-hmm. well.
Yeah, it really does.
So we open directly from last issue with Splinter bound and kneeling before Karai and the Master Shredder. Karai brags for a bit about how awesome and menacing the Foot Clan are and that a war is coming, and Splinter's like, so what's this to do with me? Splinter, though, is proof to Karai that the Foot Clan's enemies, whoever they are, have begun creating a mutant army, and so they are starting to do so as well, and Splinter is being invited to join their side. But first, a fight test. Meanwhile, the Turtles have been riding around with April and Casey in her van for an hour looking for Splinter with, of course, no luck. Leonardo and Donatello get into an argument over whether Splinter's abductors were mystical foot ninja from the past in Splinter's stories, or if there's something more concrete and corporeal. Raph wisely points out that none of that really matters nearly as much as actually rescuing Splinter from whoever the captors are. April says that she knows a place where they can go to rest up if they're done bickering like two-year-olds. Two-year-olds don't bicker, though. They have a very limited vocabulary. Back with the Foot, Splinter's bonds have been loosed, and he is faced off with a big masked bruiser with a chain weapon that has a big spiky ball on one side, one end rather, and a hooked blade on the other. Splinter, though, fights only reluctantly, but he is able to keep the other hand because he is very experienced in fighting both with and against Foot Clan techniques. And Shredder does not miss his use of foot techniques whenever they're fighting. Meanwhile, Baxter Stockman is laying into Hob about his loss of Splinter. Krang is nonplussed. Hob says he doesn't know anything because he was out cold, but they really should go ask Chet, the scientist dude. But Chet, the scientist dude, is in the other room on the phone, saying to tell the master that the Turtles showed up just after Karai took the rat. Meanwhile, April has taken the boys to the second time around shop. It's a closed down antique shop with power, water, and some empty apartments above it. Perfect place to hole up. Also has a bunch of used comics and old electronics parts on the shelves, so Mikey and Donnie are immediately in love. But it's already morning, and April has an exam in a few hours, so she and Casey leave the boys to it. However, their departure does not go unnoticed by a shadowy figure who notes that new neighbors have moved in. Back with the foot, Splinter has beaten his attacker, but he will not take his life, despite Karai's shouted urgings to do so. He knows the Foot Clan. He knows how it was once honorable. But he says that Karai defiles the Foot Clan, and Splinter will not be a party to this disgrace. That phrasing stuns the Shredder. He removes his helmet and confirms his own and Splinter's identities as Orokusaki and Hamato Yoshi. Saki doesn't ask for backstories, though. He just orders Karai and the Foot to destroy Splinter. To be continued.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know who the mortal enemy of the Foot Clan is?
That fungus that makes you have athlete's foot?
I was going to say the Lego Clan, but that works also.
Ah! And see, the Lego Clan always come out on top of the Foot Clan.
I was proud of myself. That popped into my head as you were doing your synopsis, and I actually held it back so I wouldn't interrupt your flow. You're welcome.
You're welcome,
listeners.
I like the ankle you have on that.
It rarely happens. Yeah, this was good issue.
This was so good. This was so, like, both, like, satisfying to move the story forward, but also they held a lot back.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how they do. They're so good at keeping the pacing. It's so delectable in the series so far. You're not overwhelmed with information. You're not underwhelmed with information. It's just...
You're just well.
I have nothing to... I think you can in Europe. Do you get the reference? Anybody? 10 Things I Hate About You. Awesome movie.
I've only seen that once a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a good movie. But good stuff.
Karai does say that they've been working for centuries, like the Foot, and the Foot goes to work every time their master calls them, which when I first read it sounded like she means this Shredder has been calling on the Foot Clan repeatedly over the centuries. So I was wondering if instead of reincarnation, is Shredder just not dying somehow? But
yeah, because... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, Splinter comes back as a lab rat. His consciousness went into that body. Is this a completely different body than what Orokusaki had in the feudal days, or did his body come back somehow? That's one of my questions going forward.
Yeah, and he does say that he has awoken from his long death, so it seems to, like, contradict the idea of a, zombie Shredder, or immortal Shredder, you know? I just don't know. But as Karai is ranting, I was basically thinking the same thing Splinter was. All the stuff you're saying is nothing about why you just kidnapped this rat. You know, why did you get Splinter? What's going on here?
Yeah, she's just tooting the Foot Clan. She's basically, like, giving an elevator pitch to show how awesome the Foot Clan is. That's all she kind of comes across to me. Very angry young woman. Yeah, I'll be interested to see her story arc as it continues.
It's an interesting way to try to get Splinter on their side. I guess the strategy is to show intimidation first, so that if you do join us, you'll never betray us, kind of thing. But it's a lot of muscle up front.
Yeah.
Let's see. Looking at the art in the opening scenes, I wish the Foot Ninja were not so obviously digitally duplicated. Like, especially that one panel at the bottom where Karai is arrayed and there's a ray of soldiers behind her.
Oh, yeah, it's just mirrored.
Pictures over and over and over again. At least there are two and not just one.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't pay attention at first, so I guess it passes a glance test.
Yeah.
Maybe. But let me see. Sorry, I'm scrolling through. It was interesting seeing... That's what would have come naturally. Leonardo and Donatello being the ones at each other's throats again. You know, we know Donatello is very scientifically minded, and he's really pushing back on this possibility of reincarnation. Not so much just saying like, no, I don't believe it. He's basically fighting back against it. And I don't know if it's a fear response that there's something going on that he can't explain, but he right. knows that something is weird, or if he genuinely is like such a skeptic that like, no, like until I see evidence, I won't believe it. And no matter how many times you tell, you know, it's just interesting. This really seems to trigger who is otherwise usually a level-headed turtle. And for Raphael to have to be the one to step in and, you know, I mean, he does it in a heated way. And poor Michelangelo's
in the back. The wrath of all people to say, you know, focus on what's going on and not be, you know,
Yeah.
and Leo then, and Donnie are definitely going. But I also like, even though Raph is the one who's usually, you know, the foil to Leonardo, I like that it's Donatello in this case, because this is an empiricism versus received knowledge kind of thing.
You know, right, it makes sense for it to be Donatello.
Right. We use the term received knowledge whenever a culture or person believes something because that's what was told by a book or by a figure in the past. Whereas empirical knowledge is something that you can go out and search for yourself and find and test. And, you know, there are just two different ways of learning about things. I have my opinions on which I prefer, but that's not this conversation. So, yeah, I like that that's the debate, and Donatello's a good person for that.
Yeah. Or when Raphael steps in, he does step in Raphael fashion. And at first I felt a little bad for Michelangelo sitting there in the back. He's looking kind of lost, you know, all like mommy and daddy are fighting again type of look. But then a couple panels later, he's like, guys! And it's Michelangelo who really puts his foot down and just says, none of this is important right now. We've got other things to worry about. So, yeah, it's just, I love that they have their characterizations that we've known for, you know, 40 years now, but also they're not afraid of showing that there's much more to these guys and like, oh, this person is always like this, or this turtle is always like that. Like, no, they're going to behave differently in different situations. It doesn't change who they are. It's just they're not trapped within the confines of, you know, how we know them. They're more fleshed out as living creatures.
When you have a group of characters, it is very often a strategy to turn each of your characters into a shortcut or into a single note. And so whenever you want that note to come up in a conversation, you just use that character. And I think that works a lot of times over the course of the history of comics. Certainly, 80s X-Men did really well with that model. But people are more complex than that. And so you can have that note or that shorthand as a starting point for the character, but they don't have to always be that person, you know?
Yeah.
I laughed whenever I saw April driving her van for two reasons. One, she's driving a Volkswagen van in this economy. Like, how did she even do that? Because look at the gas prices.
Oh, I've got something to say.
But then also, when I looked at the gas prices, I noticed the sign behind the gas prices. It's a Shell station. And it's a turtle shell station.
I missed that. That's funny.
I loved it.
Speaking of this economy, I mean, not this one currently as we're recording, because it's actually doing pretty good. But Manhattan Manhattan's probably never been a cheap place to live.
Right.
I have questions about how much money does April's family have that they have this large building sat unused. They're still paying the water. They're still paying the electricity. There are empty apartments above that they could be renting out to try to make up some of their money. But no, they're just paying for this building to sit in Manhattan. That ain't cheap.
To be fair, it's probably not a lot of water and power since no one's actually living in it, but there are property taxes at the very minimum.
Right.
And usually the rent of the apartments above is what keeps that stuff alive.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, they'd have to keep some heat on so that the water pipes don't freeze.
Right.
Either way, they're putting out some money for this building. That's something that jumped out at me with property prices in Manhattan, because we don't know if they own this building or if they're lease. I don't know. I think they own the building. I think that's what came out, but Anyway, they must have a decent amount of money if they're able to just let this building sit empty, and not at least have some tenants in those apartments, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, agreed. I do like Splinter already knowing how to fight the Foot, and I like that Shredder notices. Because we see his eyes go wide as he is watching.
Yeah, we get shocked Shredder Chew face.
And so whenever he, whenever Splinter says the thing that he says at the end, it's a surprise to Shredder, but it's also not a surprise out of nowhere. Like, it's not, this is the one thing that suggests that you're Hamato Yoshi. It's like, this is the something on top of the other stuff that you were doing just now. It all kind of compounds. Yeah. So, Chet. We need to talk about Chet.
Chet.
So,
this is a character that we know very little about so far, but he's intriguing.
Yeah, and I've kind of gathered he might be a person. So the easy read here is that he is also a secret Foot Clansman and he's reporting to the Foot. But it could be another master he's talking to who, and he knows about Karai somehow. It's just that's not the most natural read. So, but I also don't see... Mm-hmm. The idea of him being a Foot Clan person seems out of left field as well.
Yeah.
So I just don't know.
We have several unnamed masters floating around. I don't know if Shredder was one of them or if there was another one. But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, because that's another thing. I've been trying to draw conclusions as we've gone along about, you know, the nature of the Shredder and how they're going to tell that story. And I have felt like the Foot-related people were referring to a master above the Shredder. Whenever we only had Proto-Shredder, you know, dude with the slashy eye, there's another master involved. But they're calling him the Master Shredder. So I have questions still. And I don't know if I was just confused and reading too much into things or what. So when we get another, like, you know, 6 months of comics under our belt, if it's not resolved, I'm going to have something to say. But hopefully it's just they're spinning their mystery.
Yeah. let's see, scrolling, looking for other. So we have this new mysterious figure,
the shadowy figure with the weird shape.
April's van.
Yeah, I don't know what that weird shape is all about. If I were to randomly guess, I would say it looked like a rhino head. But why would Rocksteady be neighbors to the second time around shop? It looks like the Jadoon. From that episode of Doctor Who with the platoon of Jadoon on the moon.
See, I thought it looked like it might be hair blowing in the wind, but it's very perfectly shaped to be that as well. So
right. I also wasn't sure if it might be hair. It just seems too deliberately shaped to be a random shadow or whatever. Yeah. Oh, the second time around shot. We mentioned a few times. So I was so happy to see this. This is like one of the story beats that was in the movie that I was so surprised and happy to see in the Mirage comics as well. Because the way the story goes in the original Mirage series, there's the initial Mouser attack where the Turtles fight the Mousers with April in Stockman's labs. And that's an issue two. In issue three, they come home to find that Mousers have also attacked their home and wrecked it and taken Splinter. So some very similar story elements to what we have going on here. And in that issue three, April takes them to the second time around shop. And, you know, like I said, similar story elements in the movie as well. So it's just those recurring ideas from like the early days of Turtle storytelling, using them in new and different ways, but also the same ways. I like that kind of storytelling when you're revamping a mythos.
Made me happy. We do see Alopex in the story. She doesn't have any speaking role. She's not really doing anything other than just crouching there.
Yeah, Karai points her out as being, we're making mutant armies. You can be a part of a mutant army. And this shows Alopex.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait till we see more Alopex. I love her.
Yes. And yeah, I like that Shredder does not care about the plot. He just wants Yoshi dead.
Yeah.
That's very Shredder.
It's like you might have been... It's like, I'm going to try to recruit you one moment and order your execution the next.
Yeah, I think once he realizes who he is, he's like, no, I killed you and you're supposed to be dead.
Yeah. Runs very hot and cold, our Shredder. Any other notes on this one?
No, just a few questions for the future. Like I said, I wasn't sure if I was completely off base with the people in charge of the Foot, if there are more masters or what. I'm curious about Shredder's backstory. We mentioned the mysterious stranger and Chet's connection. So those are all things that I'm wondering about as we go forward in the Turtle story.
Now, I know last week's escalation, that was all new territory for me and the Transformers. Are we in new territory for you for the Ninja Turtles?
Yeah, we have to be. This does not seem familiar at all. I haven't felt that vague sense of familiarity in a while. So, because it had been a good minute since I'd read some of these issues. I don't think I'm going to have any clue about anything, from this point forward.
So, I mean, because I only got to maybe issue 30-ish, maybe late 20s before we picked up this little project of ours.
Oh.
So it won't be real long before we get caught up to where I'm going to be in new territory as well. And that'll be fun.
Okay. So just to clarify, you're not continuing to read as we're doing the show. You've stopped?
Yes.
Nice. Yeah. And I've been rereading the old Turtle stuff, and you've been finishing your run of the Mirage series.
Yep.
Have you finished Volume 1 yet? Yeah. Have you finished The City at War? Or are you still doing that?
I think I've finished City of War, or I'm very close to it. So I should be coming up on Volume 2 very soon.
Yes. Yay.
This City at War is so good.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to rereading it. The Superman read-through has taken up most of my reading time, but I have several projects that I'm cycling through when I'm not doing Superman read-through. So Turtles is one of those, but yes. All right, should we do Splinter?
Yes, I was going to say, like, one little comics nerdery bit here. Most of my comic book reading that I do alongside podcasts. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to read Spider-Gwen, and I had found the podcast that I thought, oh, this will be great to read along with, because I've listened to other podcasts by these guys, and they're really informative and great. But unfortunately, their feed for this podcast doesn't work. And I reached out to them and they were going to try to get it fixed. So I'm so bummed out that I don't have a podcast to follow along with Spider-Gwen, but I found another one. So I'm going to start Spider-Gwen very soon. And I'm so excited I want to get to evil Matt Murdock.
I know almost nothing about the Spider-Gwen story. It's just kind of the general vibe of her character. Intrigues me and makes me happy, and I want to read more.
Yeah, I know almost nothing about her either. The aesthetic is just gorgeous. And it was an online friend of mine. She and I are both Daredevil friends, and she is the one who told me that Matt Murdock exists in the Spider-Gwen universe. So I was I gotta read this. So not only do I have Spider-Gwen, I also have evil Matt Murdock. So I'm going to be diving into that very soon. Anyway, this is not a Daredevil or Spider-Gwen podcast. This is an Ninjas and Bots podcast. So,
All right. Well, let me know more about Matt Murdock whenever you get there, because I'm intrigued. My brother really likes Daredevil, and I've read it sort of, whenever I read it, I'm sort of, tied to him. So I'm curious to see what happens there.
Aww. Yeah.
Splinter is another micro-series issue. Technically, this is micro-series issue 5, and it was released on June 20th, 2012. So I just turned, doing the math, 33. Yep, when this came out, 33. This is 3 weeks after the previous issue. It's just a week before issue 11. The David Peterson cover has Splinter super cute, sitting in his sewer bedroom, surrounded by candles and various memorabilia of his life. He's pouring tea into an I Heart New York mug, and I love it.
I want to make a note real quick. It brought back memories of children's books that I used to read as a kid with anthropomorphized woodland creatures. It just fits that aesthetic. He is really super cute. I love it.
But also like very animal-y, and the hair is very hairy and furry, and it looks like a woodland animal in vague human shape. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Charles Paul Wilson cover has Splinter fighting lots of foot ninja in the foreground and an unmutated Hamato Yoshi fighting lots of older foot ninja in the background. And when I was reading this, I don't know if you had the same experience, but I thought that there were two art teams in this book. There aren't. It's the same art team.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Because I didn't pay close attention to the art team. I just assumed that there were more than one.
I think through inking and coloring, they're really distinct in their styles. But it's just Charles Paul Wilson III with Jay Photos on colors. And they make such a stark visual contrast between the present day imagery and the flashbacks to the past. Yeah. But it's all one team.
Wow. Yeah. Really nicely done.
Oh, sorry. That's an alarm. That's alarming. Also, we have Eric Burnham on script, Sean Lee on letters, with Bobby Kernow, the editor. So here we go. Splinter fights the foot while he thinks about the past. The end.
Well, thanks for joining us, listeners.
So while he fights the foot, Splinter remembers that Saki beheaded his children right the frick in front of him, and that he had sworn to destroy Saki next time they met. But he can't let himself just give in to that anger right now, because he has a new life with his sons to consider, and anger used to cloud his judgment, but he tries not to let it do so anymore, and an episode about how all that happens comes to mind as he fights. A much younger Hamato Yoshi gets in a fight with another student and is called down by his sensei, Masato. The sensei likens anger to a fire that is very useful, but must always be kept in control. He orders Yoshi to meditate until the morning, and as the sun sets, Yoshi is sitting there staring at the river and meditating when he's startled by a voice behind him. He falls off his meditation perch into the river and rises angrily to see, ooh, it's a pretty girl. Tong Shun is there. She offers to build him a fire. And they talk. And they're cute. And Yoshi realizes that the ever-present ball of anger he has within him seems to melt when Tong Shun is with him. So they continue talking, and they are eventually married. A slightly older Hamato Yoshi is at dinner with his sensei Masato and fellow foot student Orokusaki. They are given a task to avenge the murder of a merchant's son. Masato gives them a plan, but while they're on mission, Saki abandons the plan to run off to distract the guards, leaving Yoshi alone to assassinate the Lord Ochi all by himself. Yoshi is very angry at this, and he storms the Lord's upper rooms carelessly as a result of his anger. Lord Ochi is not asleep. Lord Ochi is not even alone. And Ochi commands his companions to kill Yoshi. Now, as a ninja, Yoshi knows that the element of surprise is key, and he has lost this, so he should, like, abandon his task. But he doesn't. He's too mad. And it's a close fight, and Lord Ochi himself even takes a hand. Yoshi takes some bad injuries, but he does complete his task. At home, Shun is shocked at his condition, but nurses him and gives him the happy news that they will soon have a child. Shun, of course, delivered 4 children over the next few years, and Yoshi is able to find a life of mostly peace and calm, but Saki is good at stirring up the anger within him. His last words to Yoshi as part of the clan echo his words for the main issue. Actually, I wrote that down wrong. Yoshi's last words to Saki, as part of the clan, echo his words from the main issue we just talked about, that Saki shames himself and defiles the Foot Clan, and that Yoshi will not be a party to this disgrace. However, Yoshi eventually pays dearly for openly defying the head of the clan in anger, and his wife is killed. When he lives alone with his boys, Yoshi at first reverts to a surly ball of anger, but there is an incident when he snaps at his children just for being hungry, and he catches himself and is able to start correcting his course. He realizes his wife's spirit lives on in their boys, in Donnie's intelligence and curiosity, Raffi's passion, Leo's concern for others, and Mikey's pure joy in all things. In the present day, as Splinter takes down the last of his attacking opponents, he considers that Saki may not realize that Yoshi's sons are alive again as well, but it scarcely matters if the Shredder is looking for all mutants regardless. And Splinter resolves that rather than lose his sons again, he must stop this threat. The Shredder must die.
I love this issue.
I might have moments while we're talking about this issue. But yeah. So.
See, I feel that it does, as a one-shot, what the other one-shots we've read so far didn't quite do, which is give us a really good glimpse into the inner workings of this character. Uh-huh. The other one-shots, for the most part, I think, you know, they were fun little side stories that star the character, and they gave maybe a little bit of insight, but I feel like this one really pulled back the cover of who Splinter, who Hamato Yoshi are. And I think so of the five micro series we've read so far, this one has done for me the best job at connecting the character to the story and just making that character come off the page.
The other turtle issues, you're right. We got a feel for their personality. We know who they are if we were to have a conversation with them. This gives us insights into the character, you know, in ways that the others don't. And as a person with anger issues, I found this story so immensely relatable, like on a number of levels. It was a very strong read. And I really, really liked the meet cute with Shen and Yoshi.
I know. Oh, it's so cute. And I was just sad, though, because I knew what the outcome would be. But I was also just like, oh, my God, you guys are so cute. I can't stand it.
Yeah. It's one of those things about stories. Like, if the story goes long enough, everybody dies. So the fact that you know that's going to happen can't change or hopefully shouldn't change enjoying the journey before all that, you know, and having them get together and seeing them blossom and begin. And yeah.
There's some really lovely art in several places throughout, but after the panel where you see a close-up of their hands touching one another, we get almost this like ink wash painting of them from the back sitting on a hillside, and it's just really, really gorgeous art, very stylized and reminiscent. Kind of has little bits of character, little reminiscences of feudal Japan style and artwork and whatnot. But a lot of also very dark panels with high contrast and sharp edges mixed in, which is why I thought this was two different art teams. So it's really interesting that they wove both of these styles in together. It just works really well.
It really, really does. At the dinner scene, after they meet and they fall in love and are married, and we sort of reconvene with Masato and Yoshi. Masato is saying stuff to Yoshi about how, you know, things are going along, things are going well, your meditation is doing a good job, you're getting control of your anger. And Okusaki just, like, makes a noise. And then he's like, no, I didn't mean any disrespect to you or Hamato Yoshi, please forgive. And I was not able to discern what, if we're even supposed to understand, what Okusaki was mocking in that moment.
Yeah.
Like, what was it?
I'm not sure. If it was just like the fact that he was getting praised, because the sensei says, you know, my recognition of another pupil's worth is not a slight on your own. So maybe he just doesn't like someone else being a star pupil for a day. I don't know.
Yeah, it just seemed odd. And it could be that it seemed like too strong of a reaction to just be that. But
yeah. I want to go back briefly on the metaphor of the fire, which I think was really, really cool.
Yes.
That anger is a fire and it can be very useful when it's controlled.
Right.
Just as cook fires are useful, but if you let it get out of control, then it can destroy you. So I like that they carried this metaphor through some symbology when he meets Tang Shen. And so he's trying to control this fire. And what does she do when they first meet? He falls into the water and, you know, you might think that that is dousing the fire. And the first thing she's like, oh, I'm sorry, let me light you a fire. So she puts out this wildfire that's burning in him and then says, oh, let me start you a new fire. And she starts with one that's controlled. And
She gives him something to replace or to redirect his passion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that. I hadn't thought about that, but I do really like that. They don't really talk a whole lot about that metaphor later, but at the end, whenever the boys are trying to eat, the fire has gone out. It's just black and smoky and not the kind of fire that would be helpful and useful. And the father is sitting off in the corner, just dead in his, you know, in his anger and resentment against everything.
Yeah. Now, something the artist did with Splinter in this is they make, even though he's a rat,
mm-hmm.
there are angles of his face that still look very human that I liked a lot, especially around his eyes.
Yeah, they do have a very extended face for him, very rat-like extension of the nose and such, but the eyes.
No, I mean Splinter. Yeah. But when we get to actually Splinter as a rat, he looks human.
Yeah. I'm saying
that, human.
The eyes really come across as a human eyes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The finding bits of Tong Shen living on in his sons. I loved. That was a very, it really warmed my heart. It was so cute.
I love that a lot.
Cute, sweet, bittersweet, just very touching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And like as a single parent who's lost a spouse and is trying to rekindle the memories of that spouse, seeing that spouse as a parent in your children, seeing them coming out in your children is sometimes all you have, you know? And
yeah, it's another one of those issues that if I were in a slightly darker mood, I could weep at this issue.
So I'm not going to go into details, but I had a similar moment in my late teens to Hamato Yoshi's moment with his sons here when I was interacting with my younger brothers. And it's always stuck out in my memory as something where I realized that there's way too much of my father in me, and that if I did not take active steps to govern and control that and to channel it and find ways to process it, it was going to be a very destructive thing. And so, you know, it's just to see him, after all of his struggles, have a similar moment where he lashes out more than he should have and is immediately aware. And this is like a watershed moment for him in his life. And going forward, he's going to change course. And so for the next however many years he has, however many of the 11 years are left that he has with these kids, they're going to be good ones. And he's going to be good to them.
Mm.
And
yeah.
And it's when he says, "Father, you don't know how to cook." He says, "Perhaps not, but I have time to learn." He's not just learning how to cook, you know? Oh, shoot. It's the fire metaphor again. You don't know how to cook.
Oh.
You don't know how to use that fire properly. He's like, "Maybe not, but I have time to learn."
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're right. And it comes full circle at the end with the fight when he's getting ready to square off with Shredder. He's talked about, you know, he's told his sons use violence as a last resort and avoid killing at all costs. But the Shredder has to die. But now he's not going to kill Shredder out of hatred of Shredder, but out of love of his family. And I think that's an important difference for him anyway. I mean, the ends are going to be the same one way or the other. If he has his way, he will destroy Shredder. But the impact that it makes upon him and his spirit, his soul, his psyche, whatever, it's going to be different. Is this going to be a lashing out of hatred, or is this going to be, "I love my family, you have hurt them, and I'm going to stop you from hurting them anymore"?
Right. So yeah, lots of really penetrating moments emotionally in this issue for what is ostensibly just a big flashback, but it's a really, really strong flashback. Splinter is so rich in this story, you know, in ways that he just simply, not even in the Mirage comics was Splinter this rich. His backstory was wallpaper to the character. You never really engaged with it once it was told.
Yeah.
And it's very different here.
And we're so used to seeing Splinter as this meditating, middle-aged or older figure. He's very peaceful and very calm. But what this one shot does is say, like, he had to work for that peace of mind, for that calmness. And he still, it's a battle he has to fight almost every day. He still has that potential of anger within him. And that's why I love this one shot. It gives us glimpses of the character that we didn't know before. I don't think the other one shots we've read have given us glimpses that we're like, oh, I didn't know that was a thing with this character. Where this one, it's like sitting down with this character and having them open up and tell you secrets about themselves that don't otherwise come out. And I of the five one shots we've read so far, this one's my favorite.
Very good. Really, really enjoyed it. And I usually write down questions I have. I don't really have any coming out of this. This was just a story, and it told its story, and it's within the continuity, but it doesn't, like, you know, do anything to tease the future or anything. It's just, this is a portrait of Splinter, and now you have it, and I love it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let us see what we're looking at coming up next time. So next week, we will cover, on the Transformers end of things, we're going to cover just one issue. Oh, no, two issues, sorry. Escalation number 2 and the Spotlight issue 6 shot. And then in 2 weeks, we'll be back with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Just one issue, issue number 11.
Yay. We'll see what happens with Splinter and Shredder as they continue to face off. Because we kind of ended this story sort of in the same dramatic point as we ended the previous issue. It's just now there's a lot of unconscious ninja around him.
I can't wait to do the reading for our next recording session. These are so fun.
Alrighty. Well, I'm looking forward to Escalation 2, and Six Shot is one of my favorite characters. So we'll talk more about him next week.
Now, interesting, because I know nothing about him, so this will be fun. All right. Thanks, listeners. Thanks for coming along with us.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
This podcast is a production of JohnReadsComics.com, home of virtually all of the podcasts produced by me, John Wilson. Each show has its own feed on your favorite podcatcher, or the whole group can be followed under the name John Reads Comics. Remember, there is no H in John. Feedback for all shows can be sent to JohnReadsComics@gmail.com, and I will plan to read it on a future episode unless you ask me not to. Follow me on Twitter @JohnReadsComics, and thank you always for listening to podcasts from JohnReadsComics.com.